This podcast has ended and is no longer being updated. The company, Yizzy Research, no longer exists, nor does the coaching program or website. Please disregard any mention of these. This podcast is produced by Whisper and Mutter. Hey, thanks for listening. I am conducting a research project of sorts. I am surveying you, my listeners, to learn more about you. This quick anonymous survey will help shape the strategy, production, distribution, and sponsorship of the podcast. Can you please visit yizzyresearch.com to take the listener survey? Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Now, on to the show. You're listening to the Yizzy Research Podcast, the podcast for people who research people. You are listening to the voice of your host, Imani, UX researcher at and founder of the UX research company, Yizzy Research. I help organizations understand their users, and I coach aspiring and practicing UX researchers in their career journeys. Katrina is a research entrepreneur. She's owned a successful research firm for 18 years. Though Katrina is a market researcher, she gives a lot of advice that is relevant and immediately applicable for UX researchers too. In the first part of our chat, Katrina talks about doing digital research in the age of COVID and why it's easy to do so, how she attempts to capture the magic of in-person research virtually, intercepting and recruitment in person versus virtually, why she thinks we have to do both a mix of digital and traditional in-person research, how she determines when to do digital as opposed to in-person research, and how she pitches qualitative research to her clients who prefer quant research. I actually want to start with your LinkedIn profile. So on your LinkedIn profile, you have the following statement: No Research is a full-service, female-forward, qualitative insights consultancy on the front lines of research. Our senior-level team of boots-on-the-ground investigators deliver valuable insights to our clients through custom research design, end quote. Wow. So tell us more about No Research.
Yeah, that's admittedly a lot of commas when you say it out loud, when you're not writing it for LinkedIn. Yes, I mean, we've been in business, it'll be 18 years in March. So that's exciting. And the company grew very organically from the beginning when I went out on my own as a consultant, and it grew from there to having what we still call a boutique-sized team of experts. We did debate that hyphenated adjective female-driven a little bit when doing our last website update, and we just decided to put our foot forward on that. We're a fantastic team. We work very closely together, and we do have a lot of female dominant energy pushing us forward to make ourselves better every day.
Awesome. Yeah, I really love that. Was one thing that really stuck out to me was like the fact that you market your company as female forward. I really like that. And I know, so with our current global circumstance, researchers, we've been forced to prioritize remote user research and remote market research. How has No Research adapted to having to prioritize remote research so suddenly?
Well, for us, it wasn't, thank goodness, right? Counting our blessings and knocking on wood, it was not so sudden. So we have been split fairly evenly between what we would say digital and traditional research since about 2011. We kind of started dabbling around 2008 when there were very limited tools. And, you know, those were back in the days when we were sending people webcams and making sure they had broadband rather than dial up. A lot of things have changed. For us, it was more of a trying to understand more from a client perspective and a brand need perspective what 2020 meant. From a research methodology standpoint, we were, very ready to flex, and we have a lot of tools kind of at our disposal to make sure that we can do things just as comfortably digitally as we do in person. But really, it was much more of kind of an economic and business shift that was the challenge for us this year. There was one methodology, though, that I will say that we worked very hard to transition. We historically do quite a lot of intercept interviews, which sounds funny saying that in the winter of 2021, back when there was such a thing as foot traffic and crowds and things like that. But yeah, we did a lot of that in person. And so really one of our main innovation goals in 2020 was to pivot that to how do you have these kind of organic, in the moment, raw, casual conversations quickly. You know, all those adjectives are very hard to do when everything is so, you know, pre-prescribed and planned when you get do things digitally. So we now have a digital intercept offering, which we are spending 2021 kind of perfecting to make sure that we can still offer the feeling of that method, even if we are stuck behind our Zoom screens for however many months it will be.
And tell us more about that digital intercepting option that your company now offers, because I'm sure that's a really, it's hard to capture the magic of in-person traditional research virtually. So how has your team done that?
Yeah, so we actually, we debated a little bit about what to call that as well. So we actually went with booth insights, like a physical booth, which is becoming a digital booth, which kind of infers that, or we hope it infers that kind of walk up and chat with us for a little bit and then go about your day kind of method. And so what we wanted to keep was the idea of stopping by, low time commitment, very streamlined set of project objectives. So this is not the moment where you're going to understand what makes your customer tick or unpack the full customer journey. It's much more about kind of a touch point at a certain time that lets us connect with many people. We do, you know, 20 to 30 people in a day. We have multiple moderators engaging with sort of mini group size for about, 15, 20 minutes at a time. But by the end of the day, we've heard, you know, 20 to 30 viewpoints on whatever the topic is, and are able to turn that around very quickly because we've been streamlined, because we've been really aligned on that key objective. And I think that actually has been quite helpful this year, the past, I don't know, year and a half, where brands need to just understand what people are wanting or needing in this moment. Where are they right now? What on earth is the new normal? You know, maybe we can't tackle that, but we can tackle what's different in September than June.
I do have a follow-up question though. So I'm trying to imagine like these virtual quick booth experiences, and you mentioned that you do about 20 or so a day. So are these like Zoom meeting rooms? How does that actually work in terms of like how it's set up?
We do have a little bit of secret sauce. So I'm going to be slightly covert, but not too much. Basically, people come into a digital waiting room, much like a Zoom waiting room. And then when there is, you know, a certain number of people there and a moderator is available, they get sort of sent to that moderator to have a conversation. But in that space, we can do all of our tech checks and kind of warming people up and making them feel comfortable. And then once they're done with that kind of 15 to 20 minute conversation, then they go on about their day. So we tend to keep the booth open for anywhere from like 4 to 6 hours. And then we have all kinds of input mechanisms to get people there, right? But once we're there, we're all, I mean, it is a dynamic day. There's a lot of us and a lot of people, and it ends up being kind of this like high energy rush, which that's what we didn't think we'd be able to simulate. As when we were all out, you know, in a mall grabbing people and talking to them, we didn't think it would feel like that for us, but it kind of does still.
Do you feel like recruitment of these respondents has been easier or harder now that you're prioritizing digital?
It's different. It's easier in some ways and it's harder in others. So what's easy about intercepting someone live, and we do a lot of our recruiting for standard projects via intercept, or we did, you know, as well, is there's a lot of visual and behavioral cues that you can pick up on that make screeners shorter. Meaning if we have a lot of retail clients. So often it was, you know, if someone is holding the right bag, they are clearly a shopper of that brand. It kind of cuts 3 or 4 screening questions out. You still have to make sure it was for them and, you know, what they think about the brand, but it helps you narrow in quicker. So that is something that kind of like, you know, visual sightline assessment thing does kind of get a ding. But the benefit of doing you know, nationwide recruiting is now just the standard, right? Unless there's a specific need, you just do it nationwide. And so the diversity and the different types of people from different places and the kind of quotas we can set to make sure we hear from all different types of people, that has really been a boom, right? We really appreciate being able to kind of tap into that audience and not, you know, often we were in the situation of like, well, it's raining today, so we're not getting our 20 people. Like, there's nothing we can do about the rain. But that obviously doesn't happen in the digital world.
Do you think that more in-person traditional research yields better results than remote testing? What do you think about that?
I think there's pros and cons of both. There's definitely, there is energy that happens when people are together, which hopefully we all still remember what that feels like. I'm not necessarily talking about kind of the qualitative, like, body language is important. Yes, it is. But I mean, just you can tell if someone's interested in you. You can tell if they're looking at you and want to, you to continue your statement, right? And like, keep talking. I'm so with you, right? You can get that from a lot of different cues. Whereas if you're on webcam, you actually have to say, sorry, Joe, could you tell me more about that, right? So there's a certain stagnancy that happens digitally where in person it's a bit more fluid, and you get sort of a lot more unspoken cues between the people involved in the project. So sometimes that's important. You know, if you're really diving into something that's in a more emotional space, or you're wanting kind of people to easily feel like they are a group, even if they haven't known each other before, some of that is easier in person, but there's a trade-off. So online, you get a lot of people who may not have the time to be able to come and meet you in person. They may not even sign up for something like that, right? That's kind of a big ask in a lot of people's lives. And also the ability, just on a technical level, to share screens and stream through what you're doing on an app, or say, oh yeah, let me show you my last shopping journey and just share my screen and show you, you know, what I did. Those kinds of access points are so great digitally that I think we have to keep doing a mix. We have to keep doing both, and making, as we start having the option to do in-person research again, making a decision at the beginning of each project, okay, how am I designing this? What are the objectives? What are the goals? What do I win and lose? And in some cases, consider a hybrid. It doesn't have to be one or the other. You know, a lot of times projects benefit by doing a little bit of both, or different methodologies to come together to reach the same objective. So I just think we need to intelligently think about each project at a time, rather than saying, okay, this is the end of in-person, or thank God I have got the vaccine, now I don't have to do anything digitally. I think it's much more nuanced and project-based decision-making.
That was a perfect segue actually into my next question. I was curious, so in a non-COVID world, for your clients for no research, when do you, or when would you recommend remote research methods as opposed to in-person? So I know you mentioned like that it's important to figure out, to have an intuition as to when you use both or when you use one or the other. So in normal circumstances, how would you scope that project for someone, for a potential client?
Well, there's a lot of factors. I think the easiest things to consider is if there is something tactical. If there is something physical, like a taste test or a product test or a shop along. I mean, we're doing those digitally now, but I do look forward to being able to doing them in person again. So there is that kind of physicality. So I think that's the first rung of decision. Is there a physicality here that we need to see, that we need to be there for? Then I think it's really about, okay, who is our target market? And does it make more sense to reach them online versus in person? Because that's a consideration too. You want to make sure you're getting the highest caliber, most accurate participants. So you sort of have to think about who those people are, what their life is like, and what they're more apt to do. Just had a conversation about this yesterday about at a certain, we had a like income asset threshold, and we had a long conversation about, are they more willing to give us an hour or 15 minutes over 4 days? Now, those are both digital, but it's the same conversation. It's understanding who you're trying to get in touch with and what their life is like, so that you slot into it in as comfortable a way as possible, even though we're doing this very weird thing that is not usually part of your life, but how to make it as accessible for them as possible to participate in. And then I think actually the next layer after you go through all of that, you go through what's the objective and does it need to be physically with us in the room? Who are these people and what's the best way for them to participate? I think the next layer, and I'm really looking forward to talking about this layer, is what does the client team need? Are they a spread out team that's now all working from home that could really stand to all go to a place together and experience this research and get a bunch of non-digital post-it notes going in the back room and really make some decisions and think tank through this? Or is this a team that for whatever reason doesn't necessarily need that and has some great virtual collaboration tools so that they can really be in the research from wherever they are? And I think we'll be having a lot more conversations like that as we notice, you know, we have to start asking our clients, are you going back to the office? Are you not? Where's your team? What time zones are they in? Because you have to, I mean, I think we're creating an experience for participants and we're creating experiences for clients. And we want to make sure they're both getting everything they need from that.
And you mentioned earlier in your response to the question that a lot of when you're testing a physical product, let's say if you're doing a taste test, for example, that's best suited for in-person, but you've obviously had to move to doing that remotely now. How does that work? I'm just trying to imagine like a taste test virtually, right? I'm trying a new cookie. How does that work?
Oh, I wish this was a video so I could show you these. The maps we have to draw about how to pack the boxes and how to label the stuff and then what shipping speed you use so that people get it at the same time. And then the letters inside that says, don't touch this yet, please. there's so much more planning than having people show up and giving them a paper plate, right? So I think it just becomes like the logistics and the planning and the attention to detail have just been way stepped up for all of this. However, I will say there's a lot of great companies that are doing some innovative things in this space. We work with a partner in the East Bay that has decided they're going to do car hop drive-through food tests. So you just stay in your car and you roll your window down with your mask on. And I don't know if they're on roller skates or not, but it would be cool if they were. It's about being inventive and thorough and organized. And I think there's a lot of opportunities out there to create some new cool stuff within the constraints we're all in.
And like you mentioned, in terms of the example of taste testing, it's not like people just show up, even if they were in person, it's not like people just show up and you give them a plate of food to try, right? Like you said, even in person, there's a lot of stuff to consider. And now remotely, there's a lot of stuff to consider logistically. And I think it's really important for people to understand that, which is why there are so many market research companies out there, because you guys think about this stuff so that the clients don't have to think about it, because it's a lot to think about.
Exactly. We haven't even touched sourcing the things you want them to test and how it needs to be prepared. And, you know, I mean, yes, there's lots of details. That's why you need someone on your team, on your side, helping you think 14 steps ahead of what you need to do.
Exactly. And in terms of working with your clients, so you mentioned that when you're doing research, it's important to accommodate the respondent, but also you want to make sure that the client is comfortable as well, because they're the ones who hired you to do this work. With that said, I know with a lot of market researchers, when they're pitching clients, sometimes clients may be hesitant to incorporate more qualitative research because it's not data or numbers centric. So how do you pitch qualitative research projects to companies that are more interested in the quantitative?
Yes, it's interesting. And it's never easy. I think over the years, it's gotten easier for us because we are a very qualitative first firm. And we are very open about that. So most people come to us with that in mind, right? So we are kind of lucky in that way. But I would say if we still encounter it. And, you know, there is a time and place for both methodologies. That's why they exist. And, you know, and now we're in this sort of fuzzy zone of if you have 100 people in your sample, what is that exactly, right? There's a lot of kind of big qual or small quant that is making things fuzzier. But I would say above all, it's this is nothing new. This is what other people may have told you, but it is about bringing the stories to life. It is about bringing people to the forefront, because we as human beings relate to and remember stories a lot better than we relate to and remember numbers. And I always see it as a compliment. You do need the data, but if you have some real people that form sticky memories that are telling stories that relate to that data and bringing it to life, I don't know if I'm going to say never, but I would say rarely to never seen a client who didn't appreciate that. Now, whether that ends up in the RFP and getting approved and all of that stuff, that's your sales cycle and how well you're doing there. But in terms of recognizing the value of the story when it's incorporated with data, that seems to be fairly universally appealing. It's just about making sure that you have the time and budget and prioritization to include it.
If you're enjoying this podcast, go to Apple Podcasts and give it a 5-star rating and a glowing review. Subscribe, follow. Many of you messaged me to tell me how much you like the podcast, but it's even better if you share it with your coworkers, mentees, and mentors on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and any other platform I forgot to mention. Spread the love. Don't keep me to yourself. Also, if you are an aspiring or even a current UX researcher who needs help with your resume, interviewing skills, professional branding, cover letter, LinkedIn profile, and portfolio, consider applying for the Yizzy Research Coaching Program. In the rest of our conversation, Katrina discusses how to story tell qualitative data and insights, what constitutes an insight, how to share insights, reducing bias when sharing insights, stakeholder management, and how to scope a research project. I also appreciate what you said about storytelling. Storytelling is oftentimes mentioned when people talk about research, especially market research and UX research. But what does it actually mean to tell a story? So for example, does that mean that you use personas? Does it mean that you use journey maps? Like, how do you actually tell a story based on the research you collected?
Yeah, and that then is different if we are doing a, let's say, qualitative only project where all we have is the stories, right? We may have some data as reference point going in, or we may be, I like to say we're in a bookend industry. So we either come before or after quant usually. and so that's fine. We like it. I think when you're talking about qualitative data only, then you almost have a heavier lift, right? You have this task of letting these, 20 to 30 people, let's just say, uncover the insights that the client needs. And that is a lot. I mean, everybody has different techniques for this, whether you're coding or tabbing things or cutting videos together or, however you're making sense of your qualitative data, to make sure you spend the time with it that you need to really understand what's cutting through and understanding what's most impactful and telling it very clearly, telling it very concisely. It's almost easier when you're working with quant, because then you sort of have the arch of the story and you can understand where the qualitative helps emphasize or explain, right? So that's kind of a different task than if you are fully telling the story through qualitative, which is a little bit of an art and takes a lot of time and can be done beautifully, right? But it's really kind of having to lean into something that is more nebulous and pulling out those themes and bringing those themes to life. I don't know if there is not a perfect formula to that. We tend to use quite a lot of video. So we have found that, yes, video sizzle reels are great, but what we also do is kind of create what we're starting to call a playlist of kind of the best excerpts from the research, so that someone can go to a folder and there's, 20, 25 video clips that are kind of the most compellingly phrased or succinctly phrased points that really encapsulate what we've learned. And that's really helpful for our clients to just sort of like click through and play. Maybe they haven't attended all the sessions, but they get kind of the highlights. And sometimes that's more useful than putting it together in this beautifully finished reel, which may not be as much use to the clients as having them kind of separate and pullable so that certain things can be shared with certain teams.
Yeah, I like that incorporation of representing the voice, I mean, quite literally, the voice and the likeness of the customer when you're presenting your findings with the client, because it's one thing for us to say, X percent of respondents agreed with this, or we found this. And it's one thing to actually hear someone during a research study actually say something or watch them do something. So that definitely helps a lot. And a huge part of storytelling, and you kind of alluded to this, is garnering insights from the data. So what does an insight mean to you? I know like we hear the word insight a lot in research, but what does that actually mean in your opinion?
We have a lot of terms in the research world that, you know, can like spark great debate. I think, you know, there's a lot of ways of defining an insight. What we tend to say is an insight that we, and I'm putting we like us, the brand, the client team, you know, the receivers of the information deduce from the feedback that we've heard. Whereas participants are not responsible for coming up with insights or saying something where somebody says magically, that's an insight, right? It's more like we have to think through what we've heard to develop the idea that becomes an insight. And an insight is typically something that either confirms a hypothesis or a belief, like, yep, okay, the insight is that is true. We thought that, we've confirmed it. Right? That can be an insight. Another type of insight is a new piece of information. We had no idea, or this is so surprising. This is going to move us in a certain direction unexpectedly. Right? And then there's all types of other kind of, I guess, insights being sort of like an aha moment or a realization or a moment in which a truth it lands. Right. But I think a lot of people think that these participants out there are supposed to sort of feed the insights to you. And really, they're there as fodder for the researchers and the teams to be able to come to their own conclusions and kind of form their insights as a result of hearing that input. You know, we would sometimes put, you know, either a digital whiteboard or a physical whiteboard up during research and say, we wouldn't actually put insights on that because it can be intimidating. Insights, you know, a lot of people think they have these big, powerful, momentous things. We just call them ahas. And then at the end of the day, we figure out if those ahas are insights or just like, interesting.
And what do you think is the best format to share insights with your clients? So I know you mentioned that it can be, the word insights can be very intimidating. And I know previously you mentioned having those sizzle reels, for example, but what are some other ways that you've shared insights with clients?
Yeah, right. Because do you present a slide that says insights at the top? Do you call them recommendations? Do you call them key learnings? We opt for thought starters quite a lot, which works less well for an internal team, but because we're an external third-party agency, thought starters seems like a safe zone for us to play in of here's what we learned. Isn't this interesting? This may be insightful for you as a company to keep thinking about, right? This is what surfaced in our work. Hopefully these things lead you to make conclusions and realize, you know, what is most insightful for your organization. The other thing that we do actually in addition to the video is we occasionally put together podcast reports, which is a great way of kind of A, bringing the consumer to life, B, telling a story, and C, doing so in a way that does not involve a single slide, right? You are truly just listening to the story. And we often use those as kind of a pre-read. So here's this 5-minute episode about phase one of the research or, you know, however we structure it. So then people are sort of primed to hear those insights and they have got the customer voice like in their mind. They've heard a little bit, kind of a teaser of the story. And so then when you get to the slides with the thought starters or with the insights, it's all right. And I heard so-and-so saying something about that. Or yeah, I was thinking about that. And you've kind of primed the brain to see it.
That is incredible. So I'm not sure why, when you mentioned structuring these insights in the form of a podcast, that almost gave me chills. That's so dramatic. But I'm like, that is such a brilliant idea. I never thought about that. So I've shared audio from conversations with customers, but I never structured it as like a podcast episode. That is brilliant. I mean, that really is a good idea. And you also appeal to people that learn, you appeal to audio learners as well. Like, some people are not very visual, so I think that helps them as well. But that podcast idea is an excellent idea. That's really good.
Well, and then someone added to that when I mentioned that, somebody else had the same kind of aha moment, right, with that, and said, and that's so great because it takes out a lot of bias. And I admit I hadn't thought about it that way, but yes, if you take away the visuals, you are just listening. And that's an important kind of, when you think about, you know, who's voicing things, who's listening to things, what's getting in the way or not. And just truly, it's almost, you know, the person I was speaking to was saying, it's almost like a purer form, because you don't have any of those other signals and cues, and you're truly just listening to these people and what they're saying.
Yeah, it humanizes them. Yeah, that's probably going to be like the highlight of this episode, is the podcast as a deliverable. I love that. That's so meta, the podcast idea while we're on a podcast. So just, I really love that. I may actually borrow that in the future. That's a fantastic idea. And just in terms of so we talked about what an insight was, how you identify an insight, how you share these insights with your clients. And obviously, client management is a huge part of being a researcher, especially when you own and you run your own market research agency. What are some assumptions your clients, especially your new clients, usually have about research?
We do get a lot of assumptions. I'm going to come back to my point about terminology. So I have learned to just say a lot of times in a row, and what does that mean to you? And how does that work within your organization? Because sometimes people will call and ask us for a survey. And before saying, oh, by the way, we're a mostly qualitative company, it's like, interesting. Tell me more about this survey. You have to kind of qualitatively moderate them. And they probably just need to understand more about their customers, right? I think what is shifting, and actually, you know, I've been of two minds of if this is a good shift. I think clients used to come to us and say, I don't understand these people. We are too far from our customers. Can you help us? Can you help us understand who these people are? And God forbid our non-customers or our lapsed, because, you know, or our B2B, because like, who are these people and how can we serve them better? And over time, and with the growth of all kinds of other input tools, I'm talking about, you know, social media analytics, just data analytics, customer experience platforms. There are so many inputs now that the questions we get asked now are, there's this gap in our knowledge. We basically understand, but this is tricky, or this is odd, or this changed, or our competitors are doing something about this and it didn't come up in our data. What's going on there? And so it allows us to kind of have a more fine-tuned lens. And I think that's a changing assumption, and it's actually changed the way we work so that we're much more kind of laser focused right now on solving that problem and filling in that gap of knowledge. And I actually think the industry is sort of benefiting as a whole from that. You get to do much more targeted qualitative research, really, because it's being bolstered by everything else that the brands know. So that has been kind of, I guess it's a trend more than an assumption, but it's the strongest trend in terms of client communication that I've seen lately.
Let's say that you have a new client. Let's say that No Research has a new client. How do you scope their research project? How do you actually begin to do that? So I know you mentioned, like, when you're asking them about what they're looking for, you may ask, tell me about that. Tell me some more about that. How else do you go about scoping their research projects?
Well, there's a wide range. So sometimes you receive an RFP and it's like, can you do this? And so then we say yes, or yes and, right, as a response to that question. So those are kind of the low-hanging fruit, but I do still approach that consultatively. So it's still, yes, you know, let's assess what their objectives are and how they're recommending we get to that goal. But is there anything up our sleeve, right, that it's new, better, different approach to kind of throw out there. So that's kind of on one of the end of the spectrum. The other are the companies who say, I hear I need this. I don't quite know what this is, but somebody told me you do this and we could stand that. So what do we do? And those you have to start much further back. It's simple in how it works because it usually starts with a set of background information, like bring us up to speed on the problem. What's going on? Would you like to know that you don't know now? Great. And what is that going to help you do? Because you probably don't want to know it just for your own edification. You probably want to know it to make a business decision, to make a change, to double down on something. You know, what's the goal? And then it's a conversation that uses those two starting points to truly understand what they need, why they need it, and what they're going to do with it. And then there is a period of us sitting back. And we do a lot of this kind of brainstorming as a group or kind of throwing ideas around. We may reach out to some of our supplier partners who, you know, have a lot of experience in that category or may have a new methodology that they're up their sleeve that we're interested if it would be a good fit or not. And we would put forward, we usually do two or three options because the thing nobody ever, rarely do they tell you up front, here's our budget and here's our timing. Those are questions people don't like to ask. Well, why don't you tell me, right? So in order to not have your guess be wrong, you know, what we tend to do is, look, if you need this done quickly and we need to go a little quick and dirty on this, here is the kind of, one of my clients calls it MVQ, minimum viable qual. So here's, if you just need to check this box, here you go. And maybe here's a way of doing it more fully, really optimizing the fact that you're doing this research and kind of our recommended approach. But because we're a small business and sometimes we get small clients, we always want to offer them, you know, we want to help them in some way. We don't want to say, here's this full scale version. And if you can't do that, you know, good luck to you, right? We're in the business of helping people use insights and value qualitative research. And we can't help them do that if they don't have an option that will work for them. So we do have usually two to three kind of options or approaches for them to, and then we always encourage a conversation at that point. Like that's our starting point. You gave us your starting point. Here's kind of what we're thinking. What are your thoughts on that? What is sitting well? What feels like it would work for you? Which is not, and that I think is something I've learned over the years to really prioritize the fact that this is not my final offer. This is our initial stake in the ground, but can we talk about it? Because we want to make sure it's for you.
Yeah. And like you said, like you kind of alluded to, and I found this too in my own company, people don't always know what they want. Like they come to you saying, hey, we need help. I'm like, okay, well, what do you need? I'm not sure. Like you said, it's like this going back and forth or like, what's your budget? I don't know. You tell me. And it's like this tug of war. I'm like, well, come on. Like it's a delicate balance for sure.
Yeah, no, it is. And you know, it kind of should be. If we're a service-based business and we are consulting a company to help them, it should be a conversation. Like that's kind of one of how you want to start that relationship of let's go back and forth a little bit and talk about it. Because that just means you'll be able to do that all along the way.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to take the listener survey on yizzyresearch.com. Give this podcast a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. And follow Yizzy Research on Twitter and LinkedIn. We'll chat soon.